So Emma's going to come up in a sec. So today we are talking about reactions to suffering. So it's quite a heavy one. I practiced my sermon to Hannah the other day, and I didn't give her a warning about this story we're about to read. And I turned around and she's just in floods of tears. So health warning, you this, you know, speaking, you maybe guessed that the kind of topic it's about suffering and responses to suffering. So you might want to leave during some important parts. You might be emotionally moved. So that's a health warning, if that's helpful or not, I don't know. But Emma, do you want to come up? So I'm just going to start with a story, which is just two people's accounts of going through something difficult. So Emma is going to be Martha and I'm going to be Mark.
Hello. Martha. As my husband Mark sits in his wheelchair, unable to move anything but his eyes, and that being increasingly difficult, we are approaching the 10-year point in our journey. It began with a small muscle twitch when Mark was 48 years old. And within a month, our doctor diagnosed the cause as a terminal illness, ALS, or Lewy Gehrig disease. We had been married for 25 years and had four children. We'd always been an active family, so Mark's quick physical demise was devastating. When Mark got sick, I fell into a black hole of despair. I didn't know how I was going to live through the pain of the coming days. I asked all my friends to pray that fear of tomorrow would not rob me of my joy of today. Because I was struggling, I wondered, who am I if I'm not Mark's wife? Today, I understand the idolatry in that statement and why that despair was so deep. I had identified most deeply with Mark as my husband and provider. In my eyes, I had put him before God. How I had moved out of despair into a mystery. I had no awareness of being called forth. Yet I experienced a sense of resurrection. During those early days, Mark and I quoted every verse we could think of about God's care. We attempted to find ways to beat into our hearts the love and faithfulness of God. We planted our feet in the truth. We understood even though everything in our lives seemed otherwise.
Mark, writing at a computer that captures eye movement. I played sports in my younger years. And I always hated sitting on the bench. One day, just after my diagnosis, I cried out to God that I thought I was being pulled out of the game when I still had something to offer. His response was, "You've been on the sidelines for some time. You're just now going in the game." Hanging on to that truth that God is doing much more than I can't, that God is doing much that I can't see, and that in his economy it is worth the suffering. But it is also a daily exercise of faith. The body of Christ moved into our lives in very tangible ways. Friends helped with meals, gave gift cards, did yard work, planned birthday parties for our kids, came and were just present. Even 10 years into the journey, we still have people reaching out to us with support and strength and love.
There were so many things at the beginning that I didn't think I could live through emotionally. One of those was picking a place to bury Mark. My daughters and I went one day to find a place. There was a tenderness between us and even laughter. I sensed God saying to me, "I'm here. In all those places you don't think you'll be able to face, I will be there." It was a day of significance in sensing his presence with me. Not just that day, but for everything that lay ahead.
I found that singing hymns and African-American spirituals in my head, because I've not been able to speak for the last 8 years, has been helpful. Many hymns are about suffering and speak deeply of the need for a sense of his presence with me in the midst of my pain. These hymns are treasures that modern Christian music doesn't even approach. Some of the best reminders that this world and its troubles is not our true home. Recently, I've been diagnosed with a terminal liver disease. Sometimes I say that I'm unfairly suffering, but the only one who went through suffering unfairly was Jesus. His separation from the Father on the cross is far beyond anything I could ever experience. How can I complain when he went through that cosmic pain for me? I remember Tim Keller relating the story of a man who was terminally ill and who told him that the sweetness of his life with God as a result of his illness, he wouldn't trade for more years. I have found that to be true in my life.
We have found meaning, purpose, joy, growth, and wholeness in our loss. How much I would have missed if I'd opted out of this season. God has had so much to give me in the midst of it. I see how the intense sorrow and intense sweetness are mingled together. The depth and richness of life has come in suffering. How much I have learned and how much sweeter Jesus is to me now.
Thank you, Emma. So whilst that's raw, I'd love us in our tables just to respond. I've got two suggested questions, but you might want to go off piste. What's your response to Mark and Martha's reaction to their suffering? And secondly, how do you think you would react to a similar scenario? Or just any general reflections on hearing that? What's your raw response? So just spend a few minutes talking about that. So today, we are speaking about reactions to suffering, as I've just mentioned. And this is, of course, a huge subject, and it carries with it so many questions. And I almost hope that you leave here with more questions than you came in with. I certainly don't have all of the answers. But it's really important that if we believe that God is real, God is with us, God is loving, and if we also live in a reality where suffering is exactly that, then it's crucial. It's crucial that as the body of Christ, we are discussing this, we are thinking about this, and we're working through it together as family, as community. It's also important to say at this point that an intellectual and a theological response to suffering do not count for anything when you are right in the midst of the furnace. The only thing that counts is God's love. And even that can be a real struggle to grasp. So just hear me now. I don't know the situation you're going through. What I'm going to say is going to help us as a community. But just know that it's Jesus' closeness that we need to strive for when we're in suffering. And if you are going through something hard, then just know that we're here. We're here to support you as a community. So there's so much to say about suffering. I've loved reading about it and researching. It's been such a blessing to me, actually. And this book, Walking with God Through Pain and Suffering by Tim Keller, is phenomenal. It's been such a good resource. And I thoroughly recommend you buy it and you read it and you try and start getting your head around it. Because there's a lot more that I'm not going to say today. So my hope today is to outline reactions to suffering from different worldviews. I'm going to take four traditional historic worldviews on suffering. I'm then going to look at secularism. What does the world today tell us about suffering? And then we're going to look at Christianity. So I'll go through some biblical truths on suffering, and then we'll round off with hopefully some practical tips or just things that we can glean from a response to suffering. Sound all right? Okay, it's going to be good. It's going to be a journey. So, there is an innate desire within humans to understand why suffering exists, what causes it, and how to respond to it. That's an innate desire. So we're going to look through these four worldviews now. And I'm going to use an example of suffering that we can all relate to, and that is dodgy Wi-Fi connection, especially when you're trying to watch Netflix. That is suffering, that is real, and I'm going to use a specific example of the Great British Bake Off final, when you deliberately don't watch it for a whole week so you can settle down and enjoy it, and then it buffers throughout and it ruins your entire day. Happened to a friend of mine. So the four worldviews using this silly example is a moralistic... Oh, here they are. Lovely. Who did I have in the Office Bake Off? I had... who did I have? This guy. Legend. I don't remember his name anymore. Michael. He was great. Okay, the first worldview is a moralistic response to suffering. Now, a good example of this is karma. And the moralistic reason for suffering is What goes around comes around. You'll be repaid for the bad things that you do in this life or in a past life. And the moralistic response to suffering is pay it. Suffering is an essential tool to help people live rightly, move on, and be good. So in our example, the reason your Wi-Fi has stopped working whilst you're trying to watch the final of Bake Off is because you pushed an old lady over in a past life. Suggested action from a moralistic viewpoint: stop pushing old ladies over and you'll probably have a better internet connection. The second view is self-transcendentalism. And now a good example of this is Buddhism. Now, a self-transcendental reason for suffering is you are too individualistic, and therefore you suffer because you are too attached to things that are temporary and unimportant. So a self-transcendent response to suffering is accept it. Learn how to detach your heart from material and transitory things or person. So in our example, your Wi-Fi cutting out during Bake Off is causing you to suffer because you care too much about watching people bake cakes. Suggested action: stop watching Bake Off, it's a repetitive and meaningless show. Slander. Thirdly, a fatalistic response to suffering. Now, a good example of this is Islam. And a fatalistic reason for suffering is there is a higher power that has control over your fate and destiny. So in Islam, the inscrutable will of Allah. And fatalistic response to suffering is heroically endure it. Submit to the higher power's will, as it is above your reality and will dictate what happens to you. So in our example, you are destined to never know which folding technique David uses to create his puff pastry palace showstopper. Suggested action: the gods have boycotted Bake Off since it moved to Channel 4. Try MasterChef. Now, the fourth worldview on suffering is dualistic. Marxism is an example of this. So a dualistic reason for suffering, it says there are evil forces in the world at play, and they are what causes suffering. So a dualistic response would be overcome it. Good will and must triumph over evil eventually. So in our example, evil knows how much joy you get from Bake Off, so has sabotaged your router. And the action is enlist the help of the good people of BT who want you to experience Bake Off joy. Breathe. Does that make sense, those four? Okay. So interestingly, all these reasons for suffering, they all suggest three things, which is fascinating. So they all suggest that suffering shouldn't be a surprise to us. They suggest that suffering can help us move towards the purpose of life. And they suggest that we each have a responsibility for achieving something through our suffering. Now, this is interesting because all of these truths can be said of Christianity, but they also all clash and can't be said of sufferings, of the Western world's response to suffering, of what secularism tells us about suffering. So let's take a look at secularism. Now, this is the Western world today. A secularist reason for suffering is there is no reason. Suffering is simply an interruption to your life. And the secularist response to suffering is avoid it or reduce it at all costs. The meaning of life is the pursuit of pleasure and personal freedom. And suffering has no place. So our example, you picked the cheapest Wi-Fi you could find and it is entirely your fault that you can't watch the Bake Off final. Suggested action: go fiber optic. So the question that secularism leaves us with is this: what happens when you are facing unavoidable or irreducible suffering? What happens then? And the answer is that secularist world smuggles in other resources from elsewhere to help deal with it. Look at karma, Buddhism, Greek Stoicism, Christianity. Even though the beliefs that have created these resources that are being used don't line up with the secularist perspective. So that's fascinating. And now we're going to look at Christianity. Christianity's reason for suffering is actually something hidden in all four of these. Something of all four of those. And a Christian response to suffering, again, is actually a little bit of all four of those. But there is a depth and a nuance to the Christian understanding of suffering that cannot be boxed up into this two-part rubric, which is really interesting because Christianity says suffering is overwhelming. It says suffering is real. Suffering is often unfair. Yet somehow suffering is meaningful. So what does the Bible say? I'm going to look through five key texts, and we're just going to look at five truths that we have about suffering. Now, these don't give a complete picture, but they help us piece together suffering in this world. So the first of which, Genesis 3, we live in a fallen world. Now, we read the story of Adam and Eve. They eat, don't they, from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And this is their way of effectively saying to God, we want to be in charge. I want a me-focused existence. I know you're God, but I want to be God too. And this highlights the pride and the sin that enters the world, where we say, don't worry, God, I've got this. So this marks a really key moment in history, really, where we live in this fallen world that's kind of encapsulated by our pride and our selfishness. The next text is in the book of Job. Now, if you've not, if you're not familiar with this story, it's really interesting. It's worth a read. It's kind of confusing. But this is a book that talks about a man named Job who went through incredible suffering. So he was a very wealthy man. He lived a very blessed life. He had thousands of livestock, servants, big family. And then one day, in about 48 hours, he loses all of his cattle. His servants are killed by raiders. His sheep die in a fire. Someone steals his camels. His family tragically get killed in an accident. His brother gets killed. He gets a horrendous skin disease. Everything goes against Job. And then what happens next? And there's more to it, but one of the things that happens in this story is his friends come alongside him and they say, what have you done? How have you offended God? How are you not living rightly? Why are you getting so much like cosmic abuse? Like, have you done something wrong? And God comes in and he rebukes Job's friends and he says, you don't understand suffering. You have got a wrong understanding of suffering. So it's interesting that this story shows us suffering is not directly linked to sin. The third truth that I want us to take is that Jesus hates suffering. And we find this in John chapter 11. Anyone know the story in John 11 with Jesus? Yes, 10 points. Lazarus, yeah. So one thing to say about Jesus quickly is that he's incredible because he shows us a little bit about what God is like. Jesus came onto the earth and he shows us what God's character is. And he is a crucial cog in the wheel of us understanding suffering on this earth. Jesus, through the Gospels, is just brilliant for that. And there's so much depth to be found there. And in this story, Jesus is going to see his cousin Lazarus. And when he arrives, he sees people mourning. Lazarus's sisters and others are mourning when he arrives. And then John 11:38, it says, Jesus was once more deeply moved, or he groaned within. And this is his kind of emotional response to the situation. But the Greek actually translates, as many scholars will attest, to this being more accurately translated as a shouting or a bellowing with anger. And it's this really visceral, angry response. And the question is, why is Jesus so angry if he's about to raise Lazarus from the dead and everyone's going to stop mourning and be joyful? And the scholar one will suggest that Jesus is really enraged by the grief and the sorrow of Mary and Martha, that he's enraged at evil's unnatural and violent tyranny that is so apparent in the mourning and the crying of the people, like seeing and reacting to a loved one dying. And it shows us that, you know, Jesus is opposed to suffering, and actually Jesus is going to vindicate us with tears in his eyes and with his children in his heart, because he is opposed to suffering by his very nature. And I think that this story encapsulates that. Jesus hates suffering. Fourthly, Jesus suffers with us. And we see this, don't we, in the story of the crucifixion. I'm sure you know it well. There's a great line that Jesus famously says when he's preparing to go and be crucified in the garden. He says, Lord, not my will, but yours be done. But he says that after pleading with the Father to take this cup. That's what he says. He says, if there's any other way for this to go through, if your will can be done without me suffering, please let it be so. And it shows that Jesus' desire and God's will weren't aligned in that moment. And it shows us that on the cross, Jesus suffers with us. You know, not only did he go through immense torture and suffering without even putting a foot wrong, but he also bore the sin and shame of the world. And he was separated from the Father in a moment of indescribable anguish. And it's just a really, really powerful story. And Jesus suffers with us. That is a truth. The fifth truth is that suffering will have an end. We see this in Revelation 21. Suffering has an expiry date. Because there is a glorious vision described in Revelation by John, who writes of a time to come. He writes basically of the end of the age. And I'm going to read a small section of what it says from verse 4. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain. For the old order of things has passed away. He who is seated on the throne said, "Behold, I am making everything new." And this shows us that suffering will have an end. So as I said before, these five truths, they don't tell us everything we need to know about suffering. They don't give us the answers. They don't explain why you're going through what you're going through. But they do give us some idea of God's heart in relation to suffering. And they go some of the way to describing to us how we should respond. So I've got three things to say about how I think we should respond to suffering as a community. The first of which is that we must accept Jesus's compassion. We must accept Jesus' compassion. Because compassion is a word, you might know what it means. It comes from the Latin, to suffer with. Passion meaning to suffer for, come with. Jesus embodies compassion through the cross and his incarnation. It's part of God's character to be compassionate, isn't it? There's a few examples of this in the Bible. In the story of Joseph in his technicolor dream coat, the phrase, "God was close to Joseph," is used twice in the story. He was close to him throughout his life, but two times he was particularly close to him. The first when he was at Potiphar's house looking at a long sentence of time to spend there as a servant. And the second time was, anyone know? In jail. Yes, 10 points, Vicar Graham. That's my mum. So proud of you, Mum. When Joseph was in prison for 10 years, it says that God was close to him because God comes with compassion when we are in times of trouble. Psalm 34:18, the Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. Isaiah 42, verse 3, a bruised reed he will not break, a smothering wick he will not snuff out. Exodus 36, for the Lord is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in love. I could go on. And if this is God's heart, if God is compassionate, and this is God's promise, then we must acknowledge his presence with us in times of suffering. If he is compassionate, then he is there. And when we acknowledge that he is there, then we have something to cling on to. We have someone to cry with. And we have someone to shout towards. We must accept Jesus' compassion. Secondly, we must show the compassion of Jesus to others. So we must show Jesus' compassion. As with all things, we should be like Jesus, WWJD and all that. And compassion is no exception. So as a church community, one of the most significant things we will do for one another is go through suffering with our family. It's honestly a real privilege to be able to do that for other people. There's an incredible passage. Paul writes in 2 Corinthians, "The Father of compassion, the God of all comfort, who comforts us in our troubles so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we ourselves receive from God. For just as we share abundantly in the sufferings of Christ, so also our comfort abounds through Christ." It's an incredible way of asking us that we should be compassionate, isn't it? Such a good perspective. So here's a few tips for compassion. Another person's suffering is not made easier by explaining theology to them. It's not made easier by pointing out objective truths or even by receiving Bible verses and reciting Bible verses to them. Our emotional response to suffering is real. So real. And therefore, the community's response should be to validate that emotion, not to eradicate it. It's so important that we suffer with our family. The church becomes a community of profound consolation as our sufferings instigate our ability to comfort others just by showing up. It's really 95% of being a good friend in Christ is just by showing up. Just be there. So listen, hold the tissues, be a shoulder to cry on, cook them dinner, look after their children. Say to them, I don't know why this has happened, but I'm here if you want to talk. I'm here if you want to cry. I'm here if you just want to binge watch 10 seasons of Friends. I'll get the ice cream. We must show Jesus' compassion to others. And thirdly and finally, we must root ourselves in prayer and in the love of Christ. Now, I'll tell you this, not really from experience, to be perfectly honest, but it is far easier, I'm told, to wrestle with the deep complexities of suffering and the suffering in this world when you aren't going through a period of intense affliction. We must prepare our minds to suffer by asking questions, by doing the groundwork. But far more important than any of that is that we must prepare our hearts to experience these difficult times. So let me just tell you a quick story to illustrate it. Oh, I haven't got space anymore. There's a man called John Feinberg, who's not here, who is an academic, and he wrote his theology master's thesis on the book of Job, and he then wrote his PhD dissertation on the problem of evil in this world. And he said famously, as long as one had intellectual answers, or as long as one has intellectual answers that explain why God allows evil, the sufferer will be satisfied. Shortly after this, his wife contracted Huntington's chorea, which is a progressive neurodegenerative disorder that leads not only to loss of all voluntary body movement, but also to memory loss, depression, and various forms of dementia, including hallucinations and paranoia. Worse still, he discovered that his children would have a 50-50 chance of contracting this disease, but they wouldn't know until the kids were 30 years old. He then said this, "Anyway, who was I, the creature, to contest a creator? As Paul says, the creature has no right to haul the creator into the courtroom of human moral judgments and put him on trial as though he has done something wrong. God has total control, power, and authority over me. Yet I felt God had somehow misled me, even tricked me." A soul going through suffering finds it difficult to love anything. We go through a process of trying to force our souls to keep loving God and others because we know it's the right thing to do. And this is crucial because during times of suffering, if the soul stops loving, it falls, even in this life, into something close to hell. Because when suffering comes in, God, love, and hope start to seem unreal. And so if we don't have a firm grasp on those things before hardship strikes, then suffering comes in like a river and can sweep us into despair. However, if the depth of God's love for us is a reality, then it can be an anchor that keeps us from being sucked into the world. So I want to implore you to root yourselves in rhythms of prayer and worship and community and tirelessly seek after God's face. Because he is the source of all comfort. And we hold some of that responsibility in us to go after God, to root ourselves in his love, and to be so firm in our foundations as a child of God that we will ruthlessly cling on to him when everything else around us is just falling apart. I want to close with an analogy for you. On the 26th of December this year, if you are lucky enough to be spending your Christmas in Saudi Arabia, Oman, southern India, or Indonesia, you will be able to see the next solar eclipse as it is going past these countries. Now, a solar eclipse, if you don't know, it occurs when the path of the moon goes in the path of the sun, and it blocks out the sun. So all you can see is it kind of ring around it, a bit like in the picture. Now, this is pretty cool. It only happens once a year. It only happens for about 2 minutes, and thousands of people will flock to these places to get this rare view. And they'll all have their special cameras and everything else. And I used to love a solar eclipse because it's the only time of the year when you can look directly at the sun, because everyone spends their life telling you you can't look at the sun. So all you want to do is look at the sun, right? And the solar eclipse is great because you get these funky glasses and then you can have a good old look at the sun. But the reason you shouldn't look at the sun, I had to read about this, it's called solar retinopathy. And it's the result of too much ultraviolet light flooding the retina. And in extreme cases, this can cause blindness. But it's so painful that rarely do people go blind because they have to look away. Isn't that a fun fact? So I was reflecting on this. It has a point, I promise. And I'm sure I'm not the first person to suggest that God is like the sun. But I think that God is like the sun in this analogy, because he's pretty hard to look directly at. Some people died in the Old Testament when they did that. But we can see him all the time, can't we, through the things around us, through what's going on. We can see, just like we see the sun makes the trees grow, it gives you beautiful sunsets and sunrises. You can see something of what the glory of the sun does. It gives us light so that we can see. And it's the same with God. We see the way he works all around us, and sometimes in the people around us, in nature. It's a phenomenal thing. And I want to suggest to you that suffering is a little bit like the moon. And it occasionally finds its way in front of the sun. Suffering finds its way in front of God. And for a moment, when the sun is blocked, you're plunged into darkness and you don't know what's going on. It gets a little bit colder, gets a little bit darker. You can't see the sun. You can't see what it's doing. Until someone says, look at that, look up. And you see this phenomenon, this incredible wonder that only happens once a year. And in the same way, we're able to see things from a different perspective, and suffering allows us to look at God in a different way. And it gives us a new side of God that we didn't see before. It shows us a new appreciation, and it allows us to look straight at. There's an incredible moment if you are in South Indonesia and you're on the beach and you're with some enthusiasts. They'll be saying to you, look out for the diamond ring. Look out for the diamond ring. And this is a moment where just before the sun is completely covered up by the moon, just over the top of the sun, of the moon, the sun flares and it looks like a diamond. And this is called the diamond ring effect. And just in the midst of suffering, as it looks to completely overwhelm our view of God, we just see something of God's promise just peeking out over the top, where he says, I'm coming back. Suffering has an end. And I'm going to marry the church. And we're going to live in glory for eternity, as I said in Revelation 21. So tonight, I just want to remind you that we serve a God who takes away our optimism and he teaches us hope. There is a reality to God's coming again that we need to grasp hold of and we need to remember and root deeply into our heart. So I thought we could respond to that. Do you guys want to stand as we respond? Sit if you're more comfortable. And I'm just going to pray for us. So if the band want to come back. And after I pray, we're going to worship, but I wonder if on your tables, maybe you shared something earlier about something you're going through. You might want to pray with someone who shared something. You might just want to give something fresh to God. You might just want to receive something, a touch of God's love and hope. You might be in that place where it's impossible to love or to feel love. And you might just need a reminder. And God is faithful. He's going to meet you tonight in your place, wherever you're at. So yeah, I'm going to pray and then we're going to hand over to God. Holy Spirit, you're welcome. Jesus, I pray that you would come and touch each and every one of us. Pray, Lord, you would meet us where we're at. If you need us to show compassion in this season, would you equip us for that? And Lord, if we're just angry and hurting and suffering, would you just come and shower your love over us? Thank you that you are a God who suffers with us. Thank you that you are a God who shows us through our pain, through our suffering, something more of you.